Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Commentary, analysis, perhaps even some insight into the media issues of the week. This is the Media Project. Welcome, folks, to another edition of this long-running popular public radio program.
Well, what kind of laugh was that?
Well, sorry. No, it's long-running. It's popular. We love it, right?
Where was that sardonic laugh?
Hello, I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. That's Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, at the other end of the table here. And separating us once again, ladies and gentlemen, Stu Shinsky.
Yay!
How about that? Stu Shinsky from Poughkeepsie. Content strategist, we call him, the former executive editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal. Sir?
Gentlemen, a pleasure to be back between you two. I always like to referee.
See, he's the biggest guy in the room, so he can keep us apart. It's very good thing.
And by contradistinction, who is the shortest guy in the room?
I wasn't going to say anything.
That's what you really meant.
Let's not carry a chip on our shoulder into this conversation.
Rex, would you reach up and change that light bulb? Because I know you can.
So, Stu, you know, we have to deal with the elephant in the room. Pardon the expression. No. Since we dealt with the
ants. I used deodorant this morning, Rex.
Stu, so our regular listeners know that Stu was a victim of downsizing recently, which all these newspaper companies are going through. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, thank you. And I have gotten some notes of support from some listeners, and I want to say thank you to everybody. There was some reductions at my former company, Gannett, and the Poughkeepsie Journal, and I was one of the people whose position was eliminated. I have to say that I was with the company for 27 years. I had an incredibly great and rich experience. This company trained me, taught me, trusted me. The economic realities are what they are. I move forward. I look back fondly, and there's a new chapter out there, and I'm sure that I will do everything I can to make the most of it.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that next chapter with great confidence, because our experience in this room with you is that somebody is going to have a great content strategist.
Content strategist, marketing abilities, anyone out there, marketing abilities, digital transformation.
He does it all, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm very good with punctuation.
Yes. See, I like the Spanish word for journalist, periodista, because it sounds to me like it means he's the period putter, and that's what I do. I place periods in places.
Unparalleled excellence with semicolons, I might also offer.
This is a great thing. Anyway, but these are tough times. You know, the New York Daily News is confronting what, by all reports, is going to be that we're going to have huge cutbacks. Yes. The Wall Street Journal has announced significant cutbacks, including elimination of the Greater New York section. The New York Times is doing it. Companies all over. My own company is going through some downsizing. So these are difficult times, and yet some may say, getting to the substance of the program at hand here, that there has never been a greater need for strong journalism in an era when we have the White House turning over to someone who's been hostile to the press as a candidate, and one-party government really returning to Washington, that we need really aggressive watchdog reporting, yet we're at a time when the credibility of the press is at such a low point that it makes it hard for us to do that. So what do you do?
Well, it's one of these situations where this is a critical turning point. We do have a presidency coming in, which will perhaps change America from what we have known. And maybe that's a good thing. But we also have a media that has for 200 years tracked the action of the presidency. And everyone remembers Nixon and Iran-Contra and things like that. And I'm not saying that's going to happen here. But the situation is, where does it go? And it comes down to the people. What do the people want? And there was a clear repudiation of the media here. So it's going to be incumbent upon the people. How will they, if they don't want the media, how will they hold their president and hold their elected officials accountable? Because that is called for. Those checks and balances are not accidental. They're in our way of life and government. government for a reason.
Now, we do know that President-elect Trump has been at war with the New York Times and has been saying of the Times, you know, the failing New York Times, he keeps saying. He keeps saying they have less subscriptions, and apparently that's not true.
Not true at all.
People started buying online subscriptions in record numbers since he did them that favor by saying that kind of thing. But he carries it on. So this is a guy who really knows how to scapegoat everyone. And the big scapegoat here right now is the Times and journalists in general. And we know that he's not letting them on the plane with them, that he is escaping from them, that the idea of a pool reporter always with you seems to be out the window. So the press is not only having its own problems, as you guys have discussed, in terms of money, but they are under attack from the government to be. Not that Barack Obama was great with them, but that this could really be a real game changer. I've been afraid for quite a while that America is drifting towards a sort of new fascistic face. And I'm concerned that, of course, that that's one of the things that the great fascists of the past have done. They have closed down the press, or they have recreated it in their own image. And I am concerned. I'm concerned, for example, for public radio. Look, we know that Trump ran his campaign. He said, quote, "I love the uneducated." And we know that the people that they were looking at there who were the elitists, the so-called elitists, the college educated, that he didn't say he loved. And I think it goes without saying, I'm sorry to say it because people will get mad at me, but, you know, if people have brains, if people are educated, whether they went to college or not, they're going to listen to public radio. So if that were the case, what would you do? Would you give more money to public radio, or would you take away the little bit that public radio already gets? My bet is that he will do exactly that. When I mentioned that in a letter to my colleagues, they got quite concerned with me, not with the reality, but at least I've done what I had to do.
I think you're exactly right. We all have to do what we can do. And in our case, as journalists, I actually like the phrasing of Dana Priest, a reporter for The Washington Post, who said journalism's moment of reckoning has arrived. Mm-hmm. And that is, we dare not cower in this moment. And I recognize that we are, as a group, unpopular with vast swaths of the public. But our reporting has to be fearless at this point. We have to do everything we can. We need to encourage also, by the way, the organizations that defend the media when there are challenges. When reporters are arrested, when the president-elect, for example, as you point out, Alan, fails to have a pool reporter when he's trying to evade oversight, we need to have organizations like the Reporters Committee on Freedom of the Press and the Media Law Resource Center. These organizations need to have support, not-for-profits, that we hope folks will step forward to support, because otherwise we're going to end up like a controlled state, like Russia is now, where really the media is no longer free. There was a brief period when there was a bit of a freedom of the press in Russia. It is not now, or like China. We need to have to preserve the tradition of freedom in this country and not let the fact that half the population, the voting public, supported Donald Trump, not let that stop us from doing our job. By the way, it's actually a quarter of the eligible voters voted for Donald Trump, you know.
Because remember that half the voters don't vote.
Half the voters don't vote. Right, so a quarter of the eligible of the people over 18 in this country supported this radical change.
But there is something, Rex and Stu, called, it used to be popular during the Johnson administration, which is something called the law, I think Neustadt came up with it, the law of anticipated reaction. Mm-hmm. So you're a newspaper publisher in Washington, or you're Arthur Sulzberger here at the New York Times, and you're up in the middle of the night, and you're thinking, okay, what could he do to me if he wanted to? Now, in my case, I'm telling you what I think is going to happen. I think they're going to probably take the money away from public radio, the little bit of money. I'm not so sure that's a terrible thing, to be honest with you, because I never thought, and never have thought, that that money should be coming to public radio, because the minute the government supports, owns the press, there's somebody who's write you a letter, I get them every once in a while, saying you take some money from CPB, how dare you say anything about about this or that. And how dare you speak your mind? You're not here for that. That's the government.
But if they revoke your not-for-profit status, you're toast. If they force you to compete in the marketplace the way our companies do, you would really have a terrible time.
So, yes, and they might. As a matter of fact, I remember when the government decided that the Catholic Church should not be making recommendations on who to vote for, and they threatened them and their not-for-profit status. So it isn't something that I think they didn't get away with it, but it is something that I think, Rex, you make a very, very strong point. But I'll tell you something. If, in fact, because everybody gets a tax deduction if they give to WAMC, for example, or gives to public radio. If in fact that happens and they take it away, I'm betting on our public that they'll come up with the money and they'll say, okay, I won't take the tax deduction.
Right. Right. Very interesting. Actually, one of the things that's happened is some of the prominent media sites have actually seen a surge in donations and subscriptions. The Nation, the most liberal mainstream magazine, had a 516% growth in subscriptions over this week a year ago, which they attribute directly to the election of Donald Trump.
I'm sure it's true.
ProPublica, the not-for-profit newsroom that does some really tough reporting, has seen a surge in donations. An extra, I'm looking, trying to, $500,000 that came in.
Sure.
So who knows? People may begin to recognize the value of the kind of watchdog reporting that's being done.
So I'll put another way, some people.
Yeah.
And will it sustain? Will it sustain?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, you know the drill with this stuff where, you know, you go up the mountain and it's a really good view, and then suddenly you're going down the other side of the mountain. You don't have that view anymore. So will those donations sustain? And, you know, I was thinking when I was driving up here to tape this morning that what would change the trajectory here? And I saw All the President's Men on TV a couple of weeks ago, the classic movie about Watergate and the Washington Post. And I wonder if an organization like ProPublica or whoever, if there was some sort of revelatory, massive story that was broken by a, quote, news organization, would that somehow restore faith in a citizenry that maybe wants to see it or can only be convinced about the importance of journalism? Now, I'm not saying they should go after the president. I'm not saying anything like that. I'm saying, is there some sort of big revelatory story that could turn the tide?
I am saying something like that.
What is that story? But what could that story possibly be?
Well, you didn't know about
malfeasance in the White House, in Congress.
Or people will not buy it. Look, there was significant and important investigative reporting done by the mainstream media during this election campaign. And it's not that people didn't hear about it. It's that Trump voters didn't care. For many of them, it's because what they were voting on was, at last, somebody's listening to me. Donald Trump is paying attention. And you look across that, you know, if 117,000 votes had shifted in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, in this little belt of Rust Belt, if 117,000 votes had shifted, those three states would have gone to Clinton and she'd be the president-elect.
Right.
But it is that area, those Rust Belt voters, those people who have felt so lost and without hope, who don't really care about the revelations, the important media discoveries, what they're saying is, somebody's listening to me. So I don't think that even a great journalist will affect
it. But none of that reporting toppled someone from office or resulted in an arrest.
Hmm. Let me take on Stu there for a moment in what I think he just said. I am sure there are going to be huge stories. And unlike Rex, I am sure they're going to count. I'm going to tell you why. Because if you see the survey research on Trump, you will see that people never trusted him. Even when they were voting for him, they never trusted him. People voted for Dick Nixon, and yet he had to get out of office because they got him. Spiro Agnew went before Nixon. I'm telling you, this is not a traditional honeymoon that Donald Trump is going to be involved in.
Well, and of course, you have a Republican Congress that would be very happy to have Mike Pence to be their candidate 4 years from now rather than Donald Trump. It would be much easier as an incumbent president. So if there is an opportunity to impeach the president.
And some of them, and some good reporting on this, are going to vote against Trump during his time here. So, for example, I'll name John McCain. John McCain hates this guy's guts. That's obvious.
That's been made clear, you give him a—and
he won his senatorial election despite the fight that he was having with the president-elect. So I think this is going to be a very interesting time, and I wouldn't lose hope. I'll tell you one thing. I read in the New York Times that the Democrats are thinking about ways in which they can cooperate with Trump.
Mm-hmm. Ways in which the agenda might mesh, like infrastructure spending, for example.
That's right.
Yes.
But Trump is the master of the art of the deal.
Yeah.
He'll give them infrastructure, all right, but they'll have to give him something back for that that may be pretty onerous.
And it would not surprise me if some of those folks who would like to align with Mr. Trump are also thinking about their own re-election possibility.
Yes, exactly.
Coming quite soon down the line there.
So our readers write, George, a regular listener, says, hello, I'm wondering what the panel thinks about the role, if any, that the comment sections of news websites had on the recent election and on society in general. Without doing statistical analysis, I've noticed that an overwhelming number of comments on the Times Union website are very right-wing. I've also noticed most of the comments are only made about articles available for free. Those behind the paywall have way fewer comments, right? And he goes on to say, it seems to me that these comment boards become echo chambers, reinforcing one's belief rather than opening critical dialogue. Often the comments devolve into puerile insults and ad hominem attacks.
The French word for that is Facebook. Ad hominem attacks. The French word for that is Facebook. Yes,
indeed. Yes.
However, however, you know, I get the feeling that the trolls are fewer in number than the guys who constantly write every single day. I get personal letters every day from these people.
Yeah.
And it's enough to make you sick.
You know, we should compare. We might have the same guys writing.
I'm sure we do.
It's very interesting.
I'm sure we do. They sit there. We tell them that if you want to have your message read on our roundtable program in the morning, it has to be a very short couple of sentences. That's all. And they write me 9 pages.
Yeah. It's great.
But you know, those voices that are on those comments areas of your website and other newspaper, and that's just sort of like one room in the house. I mean, there is Facebook, there is Twitter, there is the blogs. This is the dynamic change that frankly has put journalism where it is today, where everyone can publish and everyone's opinion gets out there, and you don't need that guy who happens to have a printing press in that back room there that's valued at,
you guys...
everyone can publish, but is it commentary or is it just
venting
something worse?
You know,
something
you guys
worse.
Always say yes. that, you know, to me that, you know, newspapers aren't the whole deal anymore. We got Facebook, we got this and that. And yet there is some legitimacy that comes from a newspaper like both of yours, you know, because people tend to dismiss the trolls as being what they are.
It's just so much harder,
disgusting trolls,
though, of course, for us to do stuff that deserves that legitimacy. That is, it's so much harder for us to do investigative reporting and watchdog work because it's expensive and we have fewer dollars to spread around. And
but you will.
As much as we can, you know. But, you know, one of the things we talked about last week, actually, another one of our listeners wrote a follow-up that kind of fits into this, which is that last week we talked about fake news that is widespread, especially on Facebook.
And well-read.
And well-read. And so Pedro asks a question about the dissemination of misinformation. Do you think it actually impacts results, or is it like-minded people sharing fake news with other like-minded who were already committed to voting one way or the other, or do you think it has a marginal impact? And if Facebook didn't have an algorithm to remove false stories, should they, as a social media company, not a news company? Well, I think it is a news company. That's the point.
Yeah,
Facebook
is
a news company, and it can't just pretend to say we're just an impartial disseminator.
And, you know, part of that, the thing with the fake news is that a lot of people don't realize it's fake. They read it, and they think it's not only gospel, they think it's vetted, they think it's accurate, they think it's confirmed. No. I mean, some of these websites, there's something called whois.com. And if you go to that, that will tell you who owns the website, who owns that domain. And, you know, these are not companies you've heard of. This could be a guy in a basement with a can of soda and a bag of chips who's putting this stuff out there. And that doesn't make it less legitimate, but it does call into the question of what is the agenda? What are the reasons for doing this? And worst of all, they're making money off of this stuff.
Yeah.
This is the issue with Facebook, where Facebook and Google announced the other day that they're going to remove the ads from these so-called fake websites. Well, okay, that's all fine, well, and good, but is it going to solve the issue of fake news being everywhere?
There's a professor named Walter Quattrochaki who is a...
Could you say that again, Walter?
Quattrochaki.
Quattrochaki.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
That's
right. Let's not make ethnic jokes now. He's a professor at the School for Advanced Studies in Lucca, Italy. And he actually did a study to compare the...
I've been in Lucca.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to compare the reach of widely shared fake news with a specified sample. And his research found that over 4 years, 39 conspiracy news pages in Italy were about 3 times as prolific as 34 scientific pages. That is, people went for the conspiracy more than they did for the science, which is, you know, why we have such controversy still about climate change.
Which is why academics ought to learn to write in a style in which people can read as opposed to nonsense.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that is an imperative of journalism, is that we can't just write... Blah, 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 blah. We really need to write to prepare. This is why great journalism can't be done by people who can't present it in a way that people will digest. And why when people, you know, in my own newsroom, the problem is we write too long. We need to write stories that are packed but shorter so that they can get to people. Because if you do great journalism but people don't pay attention to it or they don't, you know, digest it well, it's useless.
It's useless. And when I was in the newsrooms, I had a saying. I was like, you know, stop committing journalism. Tell me what's going on and why I should care. You know, they're too busy with the inverted pyramid, which was great in 1956. Terrific. But people just want to know what's going on and why should I care? And the writing sometimes does not get into it. And one of the dirty facts about journalism and many other industries is that there's a lot of people in it who just maybe aren't doing it as well as it can be done. And that doesn't necessarily come across as a criticism, but what I'm saying here is it can be done better. And sometimes just talking to someone like you're sitting at a deli counter is much more effective than writing a white paper.
That's exactly right. That's really terrific. And one of the things that actually makes people so drawn to some of these fake news sites or to alt news sites like Breitbart is that they are written in such a lively, compelling way that they draw you in. And we have to make real news work that way to the extent that we can. You know, sometimes stories, I remember years ago when I was a young reporter doing a four-part series on the something called the Southwest Sewer District in Suffolk County, New York.
I'm familiar with it. I grew up there.
I did a four-part series on the bond refinancing of the Southwest Sewer District and pointed out who was making money off the bond refinancing. I can barely even get it out without falling asleep and digging my head into the microphone.
Yeah, I just saw a lot of people get closer to their radio when you mentioned bond refinancing radio. Okay, Rex, a lot of people got closer to their radio. This is sexy stuff, people.
So it's really hard, but that was watchdog journalism, but geez. I mean,
and you know what it should have been? Where's your money going, and should it go there?
Yeah.
That's what people can listen to.
A couple of reporters for the Philadelphia Inquirer won a Pulitzer Prize years ago, Barlett and Steele, for writing America When Went Wrong or something like that. They wrote in that really what my great mentor Bob Green used to call the Dickie Dare style. And it was just really very cut down and here's what's wrong, here's what's wrong. And it was almost accusatory. It was really journalism with a point of view, but it was strong.
Well, that's an interesting thing that you say, Rex. I'm not, of course, talking to your newspaper now. But will there be a rethinking of the kinds of people, for example, who do columns or commentary or things like that, who instead of saying, this is terrible, this is fascism coming, and say,
That's why columnists have always been, so for so many newsrooms, the voice. Because more for the columns are written with more, not even necessarily a point of advocacy, but they're written more in a in an analytic here's what I want you to know way. And a lot of news stories are just so official that they don't tell you what you got to know sometimes. Or if they do tell you, it's not where it should be in the story and you're gone. You've moved on to that point.
25 years ago, I remember, I did an interview with William Kennedy, the Pulitzer Prize winning novelist who was a great journalist at the time, Gene, before he turned to novel writing. And it was when I first got to know Bill. And he, at that time, was saying, this was an article for one of our industry publications. And he was saying, why don't we have voices more in the media? He said, we're losing voice in newspapering. And he cited some of the great journalists of the 1950s as examples of that. And of course, the most recent incarnations were Jimmy Breslin in New York City, you know. And that is the kind of thing that I think he's right. We need to have more voice. We have in our own newspaper, for example, Chris Churchill, whom you feature on this station sometimes, who has voice. And we try to find that kind of thing. But it's a fine line because when you give voice, that means you're giving opinion, and some stuff needs to be presented very straightforward or else you risk being just like Breitbart. You risk being just one side of an argument. Or I guess we don't risk being like Breitbart. Oh, well. We shouldn't get into that.
But this is the stuff that makes Facebook and things like that popular because it's very down to earth. Mm-hmm. And that's what these trolls, when they get on there, they're down to earth. Even if they're saying some weird things, they're down to earth.
Well, that's it. We end on trolls. We started talking about the big guy in the room, and we end talking about trolls. So that's good. Big and little. Here we are. No offense. So anyway.
Offense taken.
Which one am I?
Stu, it's great to have you here.
Always a pleasure, gentlemen.
Stu Shinsky, Alan Shartok, and Rex Smith. Thanks for joining us this week on The Media Project.
It must have startled poor old Sadie's on ting-a-ling-a-ling city desk. Hold the press, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.